Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome back to The Wonder, science-based paganism. I'm your host, Mark.
And I'm Yucca.
And today we're going to talk about relationships. Big topic, lots to say about it. We expect this will only be kind of a first crack at what could be ongoing conversations on this subject, but particularly because relationships in the pagan community can be significantly different than mainstream kind of overculture driven relationships. We wanted to talk about that and what the differences are and some of the things to watch for.
Right. And also, since we do enjoy talking about seasonal topics, for many people, we're going into what's sometimes called wedding season. And this year, there are a lot more than there were last year. People are still kind of holding off, but you might be going to a wedding, or you might be having one yourself, or
you might be officiating at one.
Exactly, right? So not only for that seasonal reason, but also because this is such a human thing. Relationships, whether it's a marriage or a partnership or
a circle of friends, right? You know, we are social animals. We evolved in packs, and we rely heavily on the fact of the existence of other fellow people around us. And of course, there are exceptions, people who don't, you know, who are antisocial and don't really want to be very connected with other people. Humans are very diverse. But as a species, we did evolve that way. And so the way that we're built, when we reproduce, we have what is essentially a larval human, which is completely incapable of taking care of itself. And that requires ongoing relationships in order to support that child until they can care for themselves. And that requires many years of those relationships being intact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when we talk about relationships, we have many different levels, right? We can be talking about our romantic sexual relationships, but we also have the relationship between parents and children, friends, extended family, work, all of those things. And the word relationship encompasses all of that.
Yeah, we have lousy terminology in English. I think I've talked about this before. We've got this one word, love, which is supposed to encompass the emotional experience of all these different kinds of relationships. And then we have one word, relationship, which is used to fill in the explained connection between people who are friends, people who are coworkers, people who are family, people who are lovers, people who are, you know, siblings. It just goes on.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into that. And let's also talk a little bit about why we wanted to talk about this topic, because this is a podcast about non-theist paganism, specifically science-based non-theist paganism. And sometimes it might seem like our topics are a little far off from that, but they're not, right? This is all really connected. So let's get into that a little bit. Why this is so important.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the episode, one of the things that I think about a lot when I think about relationships within the pagan sphere is that fundamentally, we are a different kind of religious tradition than the Abrahamic religions that drive the overculture, Christianity, Judaism, Islam. Those are authoritarian religions. They're hierarchical in nature with God at the top of the pyramid, and they are filled with inherited rules revealed dogma, doctrine, which is told to you for how you're supposed to behave. And that includes in your relationships. There's all kinds of stuff about, you know, first of all, there's very, very kind of siloed gender roles. So there's men and there's women and that's it. Mm-hmm. And then there's a set of rules for how men are supposed to behave and what they're supposed to do, and a set of rules for how women are supposed to behave and what they're supposed to do, which is usually worse. And all of that is sort of handed to you and built into the assumptions that you have as you develop relationships with people at any level. Mm-hmm. Paganism is fundamentally different than that because it's not an authoritarian framework. It's a framework that's built around agency and empowerment. So relationships can become partnerships of discovery and evolution over time. And they have the opportunity to be negotiated in any terms. You know, it's like in a given relationship, dad wants to be the caregiver and the house husband and do that. And well, great, no problem. Mm-hmm. It doesn't give anybody the willies the way that it does in, you know, some corners of the overculture. The things that people can choose to do can be much better adapted to who they are as individuals rather than dictated to them because they are expected to behave a certain way.
Yes. Yep. And as always, this comes up in a lot of topics when we talk about the overculture and pagan approaches. We are still steeped in the overculture and in so many ways that it's usually completely unconscious. And even though we may be coming from a different perspective, sometimes we don't even realize what expectations we're bringing with us from society about gender roles or relationships, or, you know, what the expectations within a relationship, what those expectations even are. And
right.
So you think about what constitutes cheating. So thinking about a romantic relationship, what's cheating and what's not cheating? Mm-hmm. Well, there's an answer on a societal level of what's cheating and what's not. But if your rules are slightly different than the expected rules, then it may or may not be. But that might not even be a framework that exists within your relationship.
Right. Exactly so. Because by definition, cheating means to break the rules. But if you invent your own rules that are different than the overculture's rules, then you can do things which the overculture might consider cheating, but you don't, because that's the agreement that you have with your partner.
Yeah.
That's the big difference. And so, for example, in pagan circles, we see a lot of polyamory, a lot of people who are having either open relationships or relationships with more than one partner. And that means forming family units, you know, raising children together, the whole nine yards, which on the face of it has a lot to be said for it in terms of attention to children and just the sheer available number of hands to do the work of a household, earning potential, a lot of things like that.
Yeah.
But the overculture will tell you that that's wrong. It can't tell you why it's wrong. It just tells you that it's wrong because it's sinful. It violates that revealed dogma, that doctrine that was handed down and now suffuses our culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's really interesting to look at where we have those discomforts, mm-hmm. right? Like if you were listening to this and you had that discomfort of, oh, multiple, right? And examining where is that from, right? Is that left over from the one man and one woman and they have to look the part and, you know, all of that, or, mm-hmm. or, you know, perhaps there's somewhere else. Perhaps you had a negative experience in your or something like that. But often it comes from that, from the Abrahamic religions being government.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And it's challenging to conduct a relationship based on negotiated agreements. In many ways, it's much easier to sort of lie back and kind of go with the model that everybody else is doing, mm-hmm. or nearly everybody else is doing. And the reality, of course, is that as with all so-called normals, mm-hmm. people are doing all kinds of stuff that isn't particularly normal, but they aren't admitting it, mm-hmm. and they are still, you know, keeping themselves looking respectable for their fellow citizens. Yeah. Yes, whoever's observers.
Facebook friends and mother-in-laws and all of them. Yeah.
Exactly so. But when you're in a situation where you don't subscribe to that revealed, handed down doctrine, instead where you say, well, okay, you know, I wanna connect with you, and now let's talk about how that's going to work. Mm-hmm. And everything can be on the table. Now, some people run screaming from the prospect of that. I find it to be very engaging, interesting, and much more acknowledging of me as a person, mm-hmm. in the relationship, because it says, okay, I'm willing to look at you. You yourself, your real personhood, rather than I'm going to look at you as an example of this role model, and I'm going to relate to the role model.
Yeah. Yeah. So it takes more vulnerability. It takes that communication. The true communication is vulnerable, because you have to be looking at the actual person and looking at you too, not just looking, mm-hmm. at the role, looking at your partner or the other person as whatever role they're supposed to be filling, but looking at yourself, not just the role you're supposed to be filling, and right. supposed to's with these big quotes around them.
Yes.
Yeah. And so it's sometimes it can be painful to really have that presence and self-reflection to be able to really come to the table with that authenticity and that honesty in what you need, what you want, and the difference between those, mm-hmm. and where you messed up. Mm-hmm. Right? Being able to go, okay, yeah, I messed up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we agreed on this and I didn't do it, and whoops.
Yeah. Or I put a little knife in the end of that statement, and I'm sorry. That mm-hmm. wasn't okay on my part.
Yeah. Yeah. So what we're really talking about now is kind of the beginning part of a relationship, which, and it evolves over time because you can renegotiate agreements. Mm-hmm. But what tends to happen when people first become connected with one another in some way, there are all these implicit agreements that they make about how they're going to engage with one another. And some of that has to do with sort of what category of relationship we're lumping the person into, right? It's like, my friend Gary is a dear, dear friend of mine. I'm not having sex with him. Mm-hmm. I am having beer with him. And we get together on about a monthly basis and enjoy one another's company and talk about things that matter to us in the world. And that is kind of our understanding of what we're going to do, you know, together with one another. It can be very helpful and healthy early on in a relationship, especially a deeper, more intimate relationship, to really explicitly have that conversation about what the agreements are. In fact, you can even write them down. It can be very helpful to say, okay, we agreed that we're going to relate to one another this way. And of course, then you're kind of accountable to that.
Yeah. And it may be helpful to have that over several conversations too. Mm-hmm. Right. To not be putting yourself on the spot and let yourself feel through some of those things. Because you might be talking about, okay, well, in a romantic relationship, how okay you are with, you know, how open in terms of being able to see other people or not, or, you know, feel through what that really is for you. Because what's happening in a conversation in the moment, there's all the social contracts of the, you know, agreeing with the other person and not upsetting them or those sorts of things, that when you step aside and really feel through it, it might feel different than what it did in that moment. And making sure that you have a way to come back to that and go, okay, so this is what we talked about. And, you know, I've been really reflecting on it. And this is what's come up for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is, and I think that it cuts both ways. I think that on the one hand, it's important to step back and reflect on your own so that you understand what your true feelings are about what has been suggested or proposed or asked for by a person who you're connected with. But the flip side of that is that sometimes, you know, you hear something and just go and then have this terrible reaction. And the reaction can be loud and explosive and inconsiderate. And I don't mean you.
Yeah.
Podcast person, listener that I'm talking to, or even myself necessarily, but a person, you know, sometimes when people feel very threatened, they will swell up and bark, because that's what primates do when they feel threatened. They make themselves large and they bark. And part of the trick of maintaining an ongoing relationship is the ability to come back to that table and have a calm conversation afterwards about the thing that's really scary. And some people are more able to do that than others, but it's a really valuable skill to cultivate the ability to disconnect behaviorally from a strong emotion that you're feeling.
Yeah.
And you can say, you know, I'm feeling really scared and really angry right now, but I'm going to talk in a calm tone of voice. And I want to know more about this. And I want to know what you're asking for.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really valuable. You mentioned that it's a skill to cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't something that we're born with. This is practiced.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we stumble with and that we can get better over time. But just because it's hard now doesn't mean that it's always going to be that way, right?
Right, right. And what you may find is that it gets easier with time, because the outcomes end up not being the scary picture that your mind has presented to you when it was scared.
Mm-hmm.
The outcome turns out to be something that's more benign. It's something that you can either embrace or at least you can live with. And that's just when you have those experiences a few times, it makes you less likely to go into that panic, because your experience has been that when that triggered sense happens to you, it doesn't necessarily result in the disaster, the catastrophe that you've imagined it might.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So a lot of what we're talking about here is, we've been talking about agreements, and one kind of agreement that people make implicitly or explicitly is about boundaries.
Mm.
Boundaries are really important in relationships, because when we violate them, people feel violated. They feel that they've been treated badly in some way. And that can be, I mean, it can be small things. It doesn't have to be big things. It can be small things. But if someone finds, you know, a turn of phrase, a tone of voice, something to be threatening or off-putting to them, then they're going to feel like, hey, you know, you crossed a line that I didn't want you to cross.
Yeah. Well, and remembering that what is small to one person can be huge to another and vice versa. That we are all different with very different experiences. And so our boundaries are going to be different as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There may be some that are fairly universal, you know, don't hit me with a car. Guessing that that's pretty universal boundary.
Don't hit me with anything.
Don't hit me with anything. Yeah. and then even then, let's have some very specific understandings around that.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
But yeah, so, but beyond something like that, there can be things like you were saying, the tone of voice or the type of language used, the, you know, is it okay to follow someone if they leave the room during an argument? Things like that can be really, really key to work out, because if we aren't emotionally and physically safe, and our bodies don't really know the difference between those two things.
That's right.
We respond the same way. It's, well, I mean, it comes back to what's the point of the relationship for you. If the point of the relationship is to be mutually nurturing, well, that's not mm-hmm. going to be a nurturing situation for
right.
any party involved.
Right.
Right.
Right. And once again, when we talk about boundaries, there's this whole template that gets provided to us by the overculture. And some of it is really pretty toxic, like the idea that an angry man doesn't have to follow any boundaries, that the fact that he's angry gives him justification and authority to do whatever strikes his fancy as an action.
Yeah.
That is a subliminal rule in our existing culture, and it leads to a lot of violence, particularly against women, also against children, and it's a problem.
Yeah.
So those inherited templates around, you know, how to be, you know, for women, you know, do you just swallow it all and not say anything about how you're unhappy because you're afraid of,
or internalize it as your fault.
Yes. Yes. Very much.
Shouldn't have made him mad.
Right. Yeah. And that's a whole other episode yes. right there of, you know, just the terrible mind games that people can get into with themselves to rationalize abusive behavior towards them in the context of a relationship where you are freely negotiating your boundaries. There are opportunities. There are great opportunities to get your needs met. I mean, one of mine is, I don't like to be yelled at. I do not want to be talked with in a really, you know, sharp, critical tone. And I just don't, it shuts me down. I don't want to listen to it. And this is a challenge between myself and Nemea, my partner, because her impulse is to yell when she feels upset about something.
Mm-hmm.
So having a conversation about, you know, how, what kind of communication style are we going to agree on that's going to make everybody's needs get met is a really powerful thing. And in the context of a pagan framework where it's about agency and self-empowerment rather than following the rules,
mm-hmm.
we can develop agreements for ourselves around what those boundaries are and how we're going to treat one another.
Yeah. And again, it's going to look different for every group.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It is. It's going to look very different. And of course, one of the things that does, as we said, you know, you can put everything out on the table and discuss what we're agreeing to, what we, you know, what we reserve to ourselves as individuals, what we see as a part of the relationship, what we, you know, how we're going to support one another in having that relationship. But some of those things can be very scary for people. You know, the idea of sexual openness in relationships is terrifying to a lot of people because they're convinced that it means that they're going to lose the person that they love.
Or they're that it's a reflection upon their value or worth.
Yes.
Right. That, oh, yes. Somehow if my partner is looking at or attracted to or has feelings for someone else, that somehow means that I'm not enough.
Right.
And that's something that we really get taught from a tiny age.
Yes. Yes. The whole idea of the one, the soulmate, is a terribly toxic, toxic idea.
Yeah.
For one thing, there are a lot of people out there that can be compatible with anybody else. There is nobody on earth for whom there aren't multiple possible compatible partners.
And if there were, if there really was only one, that's quite depressing, because your chances there's a lot of humans.
Right.
Your chances of encountering that one, I mean, they're what, 1 in 8 billion?
I mean, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, here I am looking for the one, and unfortunately, she was born in Thailand. Yeah. I will never meet her. And that's the end of the story. So mostly what people mean when they talk about a soulmate is somebody that they really feel that deep resonance with, a deep connection of shared commonalities, as well as real appreciation for the beauty of the person for who they are. And that's a wonderful thing. But the idea that that person therefore has to be all of the things that we want in our lives is pernicious.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have someone who as a partner is everything you want in your life, good for you. Great. Terrific. But if not, then in a pagan framework, it's possible to have a conversation and say, well, these are needs that I have that aren't getting met, and I'd like to talk about how I can get them met.
Yeah. I think it's an awful lot of pressure to put on one person.
It is.
Right.
It's a tremendous amount of pressure to put on one person, and people break under it. And what you end up with is a lot of divorce, which is what we have, a lot of divorce.
Yeah. Or just unhappiness.
Yes.
And a lot of
people who are unhappy.
And an acceptance of that, that's just the way it is. Right. Well, of course, that's just what marriage is, or that's just what a partnership is, or, those sorts of things.
Oh, and that whole awful genre of jokes about wives and husbands and, the sort of denigrating, the old ball and chain kind of, they're just terrible.
Yeah.
And it starts from the very beginning in the overculture. I mean, like the whole idea of stag parties. Is the idea is, okay, you get to be sexy with other people for the last time before we close the gate on you forever. It's silly, and it's kind of gross and desperate and really unconscious.
Yeah.
And what I don't know, I have mixed feelings about it, but the fact that bachelorette parties are becoming more and more like that, I think is, on the one hand, a good thing in that women are being able to own their sexuality more.
Mm-hmm.
But on another, it's like, but it's a crappy model. Why would, why would you want to emulate men? Men are some of the most unhappy, benighted creatures in our culture. They're only allowed to experience one emotion, which is anger.
Mm-hmm.
And
but even then, only sort of.
Right. Only sort of.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah. Not really, yeah. Only in very certain circumstances.
Right.
Yeah.
So, the turning the available roles of women into the available roles of men is not necessarily a step forward, in my opinion, in all cases. Certainly, the entrance of women into the workplace and into professional spheres and, all that kind of stuff is really a tremendous step forward.
But feminism
ultimately was about choice. It's always been about choice. It's about women's abilities to make decisions for themselves about how they want to live their lives.
Mm-hmm. And about everyone, right?
Well, yes.
Not everyone. Just right. Because if it isn't everyone, then it's going to be no one.
Right.
Fundamentally. Right. Yes. And it's, and we're going off on a tangent again, but it's one of the areas where I think that there's sometimes some misunderstanding that people have, that it's not just, we call it feminism because that's where the big problem was and how women and femininity and females and all of that is related to, but it's not the only challenge in society, right? So it's
no,
you know, it's not saying that that's the only thing that matters and men don't matter and males don't matter and all of that. Like, no. This is we've got a problem here. Let's take a look at this problem. And if it upsets you that people are talking about the importance of women, that's might be part of the problem.
Yes. You might want to take a look at that.
Yeah. Why is that so triggering to you?
Right.
And,
right.
You know, we can tie that to stuff happening today with, you know, racial tensions and things like that. It's, you mm-hmm. know, it's the same idea.
Right.
But it sounds like you were talking about the roles that many of the roles that we have are very limited and toxic.
Yes.
And that it's on the one hand, it's a positive that more people are able to be in different roles, but that maybe we also need to start breaking down some of the toxic roles and opening up the freedom for people to be what they want without it being poisonous.
Right. That's really what I mean. And that ranges everything from being asexual and aromantic all the way, you know, to being hypersexualized and, you know, highly, you know, I don't like this word because it's got a, you know, it's got a negative connotation to it, but highly promiscuous mm-hmm. in terms of their, you know, relating with other people.
Can be highly engaged.
Yes.
That might be
having a highly diversified portfolio of humans.
Yes.
So, and once again, it comes back to agency and choice. And I really do think that this is the profound difference in terms of understanding human relating between the overculture and the pagan framework, at least as I've seen it practiced in the United States.
Well, because we're doing it in other places too. So I think it's easier for us to look at everything that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. We're already kind of going against the grain when it comes to what our thoughts about nature and what our thoughts about divinity and all of these things.
Right. 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 Yeah. And it seems pretty clear that the rise of the neo-pagan movement in the United States, because it was definitely bound in with the 60s counterculture, it was a movement of people who were going against that grain, of people mm-hmm. who were rejecting institutional doctrine, who were questioning sort of axioms of how the culture looks at the world. Certainly, you know, pulling up the floorboards and looking at all the bigotry that underpinned everything. So the pagan project has been one fundamentally of giving people that personal autonomy and authority and agency to make their own decisions mm-hmm. and then supporting them in doing that, at least in its idealized sense, that's what it's been.
Mm-hmm.
Now, pagans are human like everybody else. People get scared. People have negative reactions. People, you know, discover that they really don't like the wife's boyfriend. They just, they don't like him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because he's the wife's boyfriend. They just don't like this guy.
Yeah.
not, you know, he's just not the kind of guy that they like. So now what do you do? Right.
Yeah.
And that requires a lot of work and it requires a lot of processing and maybe things work out and maybe they don't. But the point is you got to make those decisions for yourself rather than just being told you can't even experiment in this realm because it's not allowed.
Yeah. It's not whatever. It's not natural. It's not moral. It's not legal. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, one interesting area that I personally don't have very much experience with within the pagan community is that there, and I think this is somewhat falling out of fashion, but if we go back several decades, when there was much more focus on the god and the goddess duality, especially within Wicca in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of that did have influence on the communities that were practicing that and how relationships should look. But in a lot of ways, though, some of those representations of the god and the goddess were really based in the pre-existing gender constructs, right? Those gender roles.
Yeah, very much so. And that's why there is so much controversy now, and there are so many people working within Wicca to dissolve that gender polarity and look at divinity as much more fluid. And as we do, as science-based pagans, understanding that gender and sexuality exist on spec, that can be very, very nuanced. And that's true throughout nature, and it's true for humans too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all great.
And it's only a tiny minority of nature that even does that.
Right.
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 It's pretty new. Very, very new. And it is. And it's, you know.
We're still ironing the bugs out.
Oh, yeah. And we'll see in a few million years what happens with, well, we won't. Humans will see in a few million years if we're still around what happens with us.
Yes.
See how that goes.
Right.
So.
We're getting towards the end of the podcast now, but I'd really like to invite people who are experiencing what they feel are actualized kinds of relationships, you know, where you have a good communicative, negotiating, collaborating kind of relationship with your partner or partners. Be really interested to hear about your experience with that in a pagan context and how your paganism informs your relationship. It's a whole other thing to talk about relating to family that aren't pagan when you are. Mm-hmm. We did an episode on that a while back, but I'll at least touch on the issue here just to, you know, so you can see that there's representation. Yes, we see you. We know that that's a challenge. It's really hard.
Yeah. I see the topic come up quite frequently about having a spouse with a very different religious view.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. That can be really hard, I would think. I don't know.
I would imagine much more so than having parents or children with different views.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's a really tough one. And you know, for me, where I am, my spirituality is important enough to me that I don't know that I could do that.
I think for me, it's so entwined with my worldview,
mm-hmm.
right? That I don't know if that could, the person that I'm with, that our worldviews have to match enough, at least, that we are able to interact and have that we can come to the table and work out whatever's happening with us after week, because it's not like it ever stops.
Right.
We keep growing. We keep changing. The world keeps changing way faster than we can keep track of. Right. And so I don't know if I don't even know how to separate out my religion and spirituality from the rest of me. It's so, I don't see it as these separate boxes. As when we talk about the physical, emotional, spiritual, like, no, that's all just part of me.
Yes. You
know, that's all related.
I agree.
And that's part of my relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it would be, you know, there's just so much to, every relationship has so much to navigate, because it's not just every single person does. But then when it becomes a relationship, it's exponentially more complex.
It is. It's a multiplier effect. It's not additional. It's a multiplier.
Yeah.
And the more people you add, the more of a multiplier it is. I mean, polyamorists are famous for lots of processing, lots of processing. And
in that case, I would imagine that, and this is a topic to come back to at another point, but that some sort of formal structure for conflict resolution might be incredibly valuable in a case like that. Yes. Again, depending on the group, yes. But even having a structure for two people for conflict resolution, but once you're starting to add more people in and then adding on layers of if they're a household together,
mm-hmm.
there's finances, there may be children, there may be all kinds of levels that get added onto that.
Sure. There's just scheduling time for people to be together.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, if you add children into the mix and everything, it can just get all very, very, very complicated. And then what time is available, you may end up spending processing instead of like enjoying the presence of your partner. So it's challenging, but the people that practice it find it very rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want to say is, I'm not advocating any particular style of relationship. What I'm advocating is that people have those styles of relationships that they want.
Yeah.
And if that is a very traditional looking man and woman in a household with children, that's terrific if that's what you want.
Yeah.
But there's a wide range of what people can want, and they should have what they want too.
Yeah. Exactly. And that if that is what you want, that's what works for you, there doesn't need to be the shame around it. Right.
Right. Right.
And there's, in my personal opinion, we got way too much shame going on.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's always the damned if you do, damned if you don't. You know, you want to be a homemaker and shame on you for doing those old fashioned, you know, not sticking up for your gender or whatever. You want to be out in the world, then, oh, shame on you for not spending enough time with your partner or children or, you know, and none of that is helpful.
No.
Right. And it's hard to get rid of. Right. I feel it. Everybody deals with it.
It's been the primary enforcement weapon for the overculture for centuries.
Yeah.
You know, the use of shame. And not just like social shame, like the Scarlet Letter, but internalized shame.
Mm-hmm.
The sense of doing wrong because you're violating that doctrine that has been, you know, kind of beaten into you by the fact that you live in this culture. Mm-hmm. You've seen it over and over. You've seen it in a million movies. Nemea and I have a joke that polyamory would destroy most movies.
Yes.
Because all the tension, all the conflict, you know, all the love triangles, it would just destroy the plot of many dramas, almost all the romantic comedies.
Just honest communication, what you're feeling, you know, or yes. Common sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, put a drop of common sense in there and it whole thing dissolves.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, and the shame about the shame thing is that it doesn't serve anyone.
No.
It's not like there's someone winning, so to say, out of any of it. We're all just suffering from it.
Right. Well, I mean, if you really buy into the mainstream framework, then the idea is that the shame is driving you to walk the straight and narrow so that you can go to, but we don't buy any of that. And we just, you know, we don't buy any single part of that.
Yeah.
And if you do, well, power to you, enjoy that if that's the path that you want to walk. But what we're doing here is really keyed at happiness.
Yeah.
Here in this world that we know that is here. And
I personally doubt that there's anything afterwards, right? I think that we are a beautiful, wonderful collection of atoms that breaks apart and becomes part of another beautiful, wonderful collection of atoms at some point. That I could be wrong. I highly doubt that there is something, but what I do know is that there is now.
There's
me. I'm here. Yeah. This is all I know that I get. And I don't even know if I get tomorrow.
Right. Right. So pursuit of practices and values that foster happiness become very important. because what else are we doing here? And it's not just our own happiness. It's the happiness of those around us. It's the happiness of the ecosystem. It's the happiness of the future as well as our own. Honestly, if this is all there is, what other possible value set would make any sense? Because accumulating lots of stuff, you're still going to die. Accumulating a lot of power, you're still going to die. If you accumulate power and you use it for good, well, I can see some rationale for that. So, you know, I have a couple of friends who are in Congress and they're good people and they're doing good work and I'm glad that they're there. But I don't know. I just, it's unfathomable to me why people would cling to the guilt and the shame around their desire and around their wish to connect with other people and around their doing the things that they love. It's just, it's not helping anybody.
Yeah.
Certainly not helping the people that are feeling that.
And this relationship thing, right? Again, everybody's going to come into it with a different approach, different hopes from it. For me, it really just always comes back to, it's about nurturing each other and supporting each other in that beautiful, happy, meaningful, joyous life.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it comes down to. And it's not easy all the time.
No.
And the whole, the love will carry you through happily ever after, I don't really believe in that. I think that it takes work. It takes commitment. You're gonna be pissed off at them because right. They're gonna do something that is just, what the hell were they thinking? And frankly, you're gonna too, because we're humans, mm-hmm. right? And everything changes, and being able to come back, just always being able to come back to that table with that honesty and that self-reflection and re-evaluation is what lets us take this journey together and help each other through it.
Right. Right. And not be alone.
Yeah.
To feel truly seen and connected and valued over a long period of time, which will be an evolutionary journey. It will not be the same as when you started. So if you do decide to write down some agreements, I suggest you revisit them every few years.
Mm-hmm.
Tear them up and start over, because people change.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that we've seen with the Abrahamic religions is that once you write things down, they don't change. You might reinterpret them, but they're really locked in on the page, and you don't want to be locked in.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be having agreements that fulfill who you are at this time.
Yeah. They keep growing and changing like that river,
mm-hmm.
right? It's the same river, or is it? Love that, right? And it keeps readjusting itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. One of the really cool archaeological finds in the American South is a steamship. A river steamer that sank with all of its cargo and was rediscovered in an Arkansas cornfield, something like a mile and a half from the Mississippi River, because that's where the river used to be.
That's great.
It is really cool. All the stuff was there. And so there's now a museum but yeah, the river moved.
Mm-hmm. So we'll come back to this topic again, mm-hmm. but this was our kind of our intro, our thinking about relationships, thinking about wedding season or revows or all of that stuff.
And if you're doing those things, our fondest wishes to you and best of luck. And we hope you have a beautiful day.
Well, thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Thanks, Yucca.